Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Lucy Barker about her historical novel, The Other Side of Mrs. Wood. Lucy was the runner-up for the Curtis Brown First Novel Prize with an early partial draft of her novel. She holds an MA in Victorian Studies from Birkbeck University of London, and she lives in Bath with her husband and two small children. In this episode, we discuss her interest in Victorian seances and the true story that inspired her novel, how she created a warm and witty voice, and how Lucy's lack of faith in herself meant things didn't work out with an agent in her 20s, but becoming a runner-up in the competition gave her a confidence in later life. But before we hear that, here's Lucy with an excerpt from The Other Side of Mrs. Wood.
February 1873, 27 Chepstow Villas, Notting Hill. Mrs. Wood's seances took place in the dark, just as all interesting things should. That evening, as the last candle wavered on the sideboard in the smart Notting Hill villa, London's most influential and affluent believers held their breath. In a few moments, the corridor to the other side would open, and any one of their desperately missed beloveds might make their way through. Taffeta shifted and bracelets shivered amidst a flurry of cleared throats, but the great medium, Mrs. Wood, was in no hurry. She sat calmly in her ornate chair before them all, her flickering shadow cast long against the closed shutters of the bay window behind. She drew in a long, slow breath, her eyes moving easily over the faces turned expectantly back. She was their sun, and they were her blooms. There were, as usual, 24 guests, poised for an evening of spirit and spectacle. Most were patrons, their gems signalling to her in the gloom. But here and there were the unfamiliar faces of those grieving souls who had applied to enter the monthly ballot for one of only 8 seats available to the masses at each of her monthly grand seances. Tonight, Mrs. Wood looked for those carefully selected 8 for whom she had tailored the evening. In the front row, she noted a pocket-eyed woman clutching a carte de visite. Beside her sat a man of clearly moderate means, a careless nature betrayed by his unappealingly splayed knees. Behind them she took in the mother and daughter in twee matching dresses and another man a little further along whose jacket was coming unstitched along the left lapel. A well-padded woman sat in the back row fanning herself with a ringless left hand, and there in the far corner a young couple. Ah, there they were. So easy to spot in the end. The only two people in the entire room not staring back at her. Instead, they sat pressed together, staring silently into their laps, their sadness so captivating that for a moment she was snared, unable to look away. But then the faintest of coughs by her ear returned her to the room, and drawing in a long breath, she released one last enigmatic smile. "The candle, Mr. Larson," she said, and her candle snuffer extraordinaire leapt from his seat at the end of the row, docking the final flame and plunging the room into a darkness as absolute as death. Mrs. Wood inhaled the collective frisson before exhaling loudly and pronouncing, "We begin, as always, with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father."
Hi, Lucy. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Other Side of Mrs. Wood.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Chloe. I'm really excited. I've been looking forward to this.
So can you start, Lucy, by giving us an introduction to The Other Side of Mrs. Wood and tell us what it's all about?
So The Other Side of Mrs. Wood is the story of two warring mediums. It's set in 1873 London, and it's the Mrs. Wood of the title is a very established, very successful older medium who has been ruling the spiritualist scene in London for the past 15 years. And whilst her flag is flying very high, she's also aware that these young things are starting to come up with different stories and different talents, and she's beginning to notice that interest is starting to wane, not massively, but she can see it coming. And also her patrons, who she relies on for her income, are getting older, and again she can see what's going to happen there. So when a young girl, Miss Finch, approaches her and asks her if she will take her on as an apprentice, she leaps at the chance because she thinks, this is it. This is my opportunity to spice up my brand and make me keep me relevant for the future years and keep me secure and safe financially. So she takes her on. Miss Finch might have other plans, however.
Yes, indeed. And we'll avoid spoilers in the chat just to make sure, but I'd love if you could give us a little bit of the background to the development of the idea of this novel, because it's sort of loosely inspired by a true story which you do write about in the back of the book. But I'd love if you could, for the benefit of the podcast listeners, kind of explain your first inspiration for this novel.
Yes, so the inspiration comes from two mediums who were very active on the spiritual scene in 1870s London. And actually, for the younger one, she was actually quite active across the world. Anyway, I'll go into detail now, which is, so Mrs. Wood is based on Agnes Guppy, who was, as I say, a very successful medium. She started in London in the late 1850s and was going really until her death in the early 1900s. She was most well known for this incredible apport. An apport is where you move the spirits move something within like a spiritualist environment. A seance was happening in Lamb's Conduit Street in Fitzrovia, and out of the blue, Mrs. Guppy appeared in the middle of the table, wearing nothing but her house coat and her stockinged feet, and she had her accounts book, and it was as though she had been lifted from her house all the way over in Highbury, all the way over to Lamb's Conduit Street. So from this, she was called the Flying Enchantress. So the Flying Enchantress was, she had a huge amount of followers, patrons. She was incredibly successful. They wrote about her all the time. Miss Finch is based on Florence Cook. Florence Cook, some of your listeners will probably have heard of her if they're going to have heard of any medium from London in that period, because she was the first British medium to materialize a full spirit. And she did this when she was probably 15 or 16 years old in her parents' little front room in Hackney. She acquired loads and loads of patrons, became very successful. And Mrs. Guppy was reportedly very uncomfortable with this and very jealous of this pretty young successful thing coming in and stealing her thunder. There are lots of kind of rumors swirling around this. There are lots of people writing in the spiritualist newspapers about it. There were letters going back and forth that we've seen. Unsurprisingly, these were mostly written by men. In fact, I'll probably say all of them were written by men, and the most cutting rumors were definitely generated by two American mediums who were men, because it was an opportunity to cut down the woman who was threatening them. So I just found that conflict between an older woman with a huge amount of experience being threatened by a younger woman who eventually was so bold and brave. She actually, she was exposed far too many times, and she was cast out of the community by the I guess, by the early 1880s. And I loved that kind of like that juxtaposition of two women of with power and authority within that period. And it, of course, you know, it's a patriarchal society. So, you know, there's still an element of control by men in terms of the finances. But they were the names. They were the people, the women who were performing these incredibly daring, incredibly impressive performances to huge acclaim, you know, and no one's really done, well, no one during that period ever did anything like Mrs. Guppy did with her huge report. And whilst there are lots of materializations, you know, Florence Cook is known as the first woman, the first girl who did it.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, the challenge, I suppose, for historical fiction writers is to write about women, I think particularly because audiences now want to read women who are, you know, have agency, have power, have their own lives. And it's very difficult to write that kind of woman in a society where, like you say, everything, finances are controlled by men. And so it's interesting to read a novel where the women, I mean, the novel is dominated by women and women who have careers and success. And that's, you know, that's a great thing to read. I wondered whether you could tell us a little bit more about the eponymous Mrs. Wood. She's quite a modern character in a way, a modern kind of sensibility. So can you tell us a little bit about how you created her?
So Mrs. Wood she was the last kind of character to really fully evolve as I was writing it, which quite often happens with when I write. My main characters tend to be quite passive, but then on the second go round, I got her. I really got her. Once I knew what the story was, I could really dig in deep with her. I think one of my passions is Victorian history, social history, women's history in the 19th century. I'm really fascinated by the ordinary woman doing what we would, or what would have been, no, that's not right at all. Ordinary women doing slightly extraordinary things, because there were lots of women doing this. There were lots of women making, having successful lives within those constraints of a patriarchal society. And I wanted to write about a woman who saw financial success as something that she wanted to attain, because I didn't want it to be a love story. I didn't want it to be a story about a struggling kind of like coming up from the gutters, although there is an element of that. But I think those tropes are, I love them. They're great. And I enjoy reading books about them, but I wanted Mrs. Wood to be something different. I wanted her to be confident in her own abilities. I didn't want her to feel as though she was vulnerable in herself. She is vulnerable because of the circumstance that happens to her.
So what is it about seances and mediums then that are such a big interest to you?
Oh God, they're magical, aren't they? In every single way. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with ghosts, poltergeists, seances, speaking to the dead, everything. I would always getting out really quite inappropriate books from the library, from the adult section. Not that kind of inappropriate, but you know, like properly scary, not horror. I was just fascinated by like the idea of the other, and that's never really left me. I don't know if I'm a believer, but I do know that I don't know, and I think there's a certain arrogance to say that there definitely isn't another side, and isn't it lovely to think that there might be? And then I, as a writer, when I was reading about I did an MA in Victorian Studies at Birkbeck, and as part of that, I did a module on religion in the 19th century. And part of that was learning about spiritualism, or studying spiritualism and how it worked within that society and why it was popular and all that kind of stuff. And I knew as a writer that there was so much there. There's, you know, those seances, I couldn't wait to start writing those seances, you know, getting really stuck in and creating this world of eccentric and interesting characters.
Did you go to any when you were writing the novel, like a modern, obviously a modern day?
No, I didn't, because they're so different to silences today are so different to how they would have been then. You know, they were much more theatrical in the 19th century, I'd say. But I did go to, I did see a medium, and I was impressed. And which is again why I'm like, I really want to believe. But I think, most of the stuff that's in the seances, I'd say pretty much 99% of the stuff that's in the seances, I actually got from my research. There was a spiritualist called Georgiana Horton who was within Mrs. Guppy's circle. And Georgiana Horton was a spiritualist artist as well as a spiritualist. And she was incredibly earnest, and she kept the most detailed diaries of the seances, and they are absolutely delicious, and they were perfect for magpieing from, as I like to call, rather than stealing from. But so everything that you read in there, as ridiculous or as outlandish as it may seem, all of it was true. All of it did happen in seances. Whether or not it was true truly from the spirits, who's to say? But it definitely happened to Georgiana. And she really believed in it, and her diaries are so lovely. She's such a wonderful woman.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about your research then, because you mentioned obviously the MA in Victorian Studies. And I know just from speaking to you before we recorded that you're not a planner. You write as it's come to you. So how does your research then fit in around all this? Do you kind of dip in and out? Do you do all your research first and then write? What's your methodology about how you wrote this book alongside your research?
I think because I had all the foundation stuff, so although my auntie always reminds me that I don't know my kings and queens, but one day I will know that, and prime ministers, one day I will know that. But because I had the foundations of it, so I understood what society was like during that period, I was okay to kind of get started. But then because I am a bit of a pantser, although this time around I seem to be a bit more of a plotter, which is bizarre, but because I'm a pantser, I tend to research as I go. I use visual cues to get me going. So I'll have images of a room or, you know, things that I know are going to come up in my first few chapters of writing. I use those to get me going. And then if something comes up, I'll go and research that, like a specific thing. But I fit it in around it. I think if I was to research it before I wrote it, I'd never start writing. There would always be something that I think I didn't know. Mm. You don't know what you don't know until you don't know it.
That is very true. I like the idea of having kind of a photo, I don't know, on your computer or by your side while you're trying to figure out a scene. Does that mean I'm trying to get a sense of kind of like how you write? So does that mean you kind of write scenes out of order? You kind of write them when you think of them, or do you write them in kind of chronological order as the story goes?
I write in a linear way. Mm. Book two has been slightly different, but book one definitely completely linear from beginning to end. I've never really understood how anyone cannot do it like that. But as I say, I'm having a slightly different experience this time. Because Mrs. Wood is quite a domestic novel, it's set within these darkened rooms. Having those images, they immediately convey the sense of tone and the sense of feel. So it's more that than, or I don't tend to have images of people. I can't do that because I don't even know what my characters necessarily look like. They are just like they have eyes and a nose and a mouth, maybe, and hair, but I wouldn't be able to pick them out of a crowd. I just have a sense of them. So I might have a dress or, you know, whatever, but I think it's more to create that sense and the tone and that kind of thing. So yeah, so no, I write in a very linear way. I'm very boring.
One thing I have to ask you about, because it's such a sort of draw of your novel, because it makes it so much fun to read, is the narrative voice and the tone of the novel, because it's got such a sort of wit and humor about it. And I saw a quote from you where you said your editor described your writing as similar to Austen, and how What a pressure to live up to. So how did you manage to reach that kind of tone of voice? Or was that something that as soon as you started writing, that voice was the thing that propelled you through the novel?
It's the voice that propelled me through. I mean, my natural writing style is like that. It is kind of, I find it really difficult to be serious. I don't like really to be serious. I like to read books that have a warmth and an identity in their tone. So I think it certainly was I didn't try to do any of that. I was just having fun. We just then as you go into book two, you're like, have fun, go on, have fun. It's the only way you can write. But you know, I think you know the set pieces of what my editor was referring to, where there's lots of people and you know at parties and things like that, and those are an absolute joy to write because it's you're just skewering all of these different types of personalities, and that is just totally my bag. I love that. If I could just write massive party scenes all the time, I would have a book.
Just set all your books during, yeah, I don't know, special occasions or something, and then you can write all the parties. And
Oh my God, I'm going to write the next one about coronation.
I think I had an interview with you where you said you were sort of being asked about women in the Victorian era compared to women now, and you were saying, well, of course women in the Victorian era would go and bitch about people and have that kind of gossip. It's not like the part people in the past we tend to think of as like a whole different species, but actually they're like exactly the same as us, just having different experiences.
And that's something which I definitely wanted to convey in the book as well. And it's, you know, and it's how Mrs. Wood was formed as well, you know, but those, so yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to convey in those social scenes. And you know, when they're in the circle, like, you know, you're right, we sanitize the past. We want that to, you know, we want to see them as a, you know, a merchant ivory kind of production. We want them to be like that, but they're human beings, you know, they're so very close in terms of history to us. Also, you know, the issues that bothered them socially, pretty much the same as the ones that still bother us now. So if they have, you know, those women were just like us. They were, you know, they had the same needs, the same wants. Some of them were frustrated, some of them were successful. You know, they're just humans, and I love that about them, and I really want to color them up like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you've done a great job of doing that. I
Oh,
wondered
thank you.
what the kind of, I guess, the biggest challenge was for you writing this book. Kind of, was there a hurdle that you can remember thinking, I'm just never going to get over this, I'm never going to get this book down, or I'm never going to achieve what I want to achieve? Can you remember kind of any moment like that?
Well, I think as a writer, you feel that pretty much every time you look at your manuscript, don't you? Yeah, I think because I was hanging it around this true story, it was figuring out how to bring that true story in. And the true story, as I say, is that rivalry between Agnes Guppy and Florence Cook. But it is based on this one piece where this one piece of gossip where Mrs. Guppy, this older woman, is saying that she would like to throw vitriol in Florence Cook's face, which is a horrendous thing to say. I doubt that she said it. It was totally sold on by these jealous men. But it was that moment that I really wanted to kind of that really a, that brutality out of nowhere. But I couldn't figure out a way. I didn't want to have a story that was necessarily about that kind of violence, but I wanted to have something which reflected that kind of rivalry. But I only had one moment. I didn't have a beginning, a middle, or an end. I didn't have a traditional, there was no arc there. It was literally just a moment. So building that story around it, and also building a rivalry that you believed, which between a woman who's just about to turn 40 and a 16-year-old girl. You know, like, how does that sit? So that was something which I really struggled with. Just making the story work and be believable, and also finishing it. I'd always just done one draft and gone, ta-da, and thought that was it. That's me done. Why isn't anyone buying it? And then suddenly I realized, like, oh, no, there's more. Okay. Oh, there's another draft. Oh, there's another draft. That was intense.
There is actually,
that was definitely a learning curve.
In your acknowledgements where you thank one friend for helping you write the beginning of your book and another friend help you write the end of the book. Can you remember, was there kind of a nugget of advice, or were they just kind of cheering you on? What was the thing, what were the key things that they kind of gave you to finish and to start this book?
It literally gave me the idea. So it's very literal. So Fran Quinn, who is author of The Smallest Man and That Bone Setter Woman, who I did the Curtis Brown writing course with in 2014, is a really good friend of mine. And we go away writing, or we have done in the past, quite a lot. And she saw the Curtis Brown first novel award. As you can see, I've got that off pat. And anyway, so she saw the award and she said, you're going to write, you need to enter this. And I was like, well, I'm not really writing anything at the moment. And so she was like, well, go and find, right, tell me what you're interested in and then we'll work out something from there. So I told her what I was interested in. She said, okay, fine, go write that. And so I did. So she whipped me into getting it started. And then I was away with our other friend, Kate, and who also writes, who's also a beautiful writer. And I was stuck with the ending. I couldn't make it work. And she said, why don't you just do this? And so I did, and it worked. Not the very, very ending, but like the kind of climax of it. And I was like, oh yeah, no, I do that. And that was it. So literally they gave me the beginning and the end.
Thank God for friends who are kind of ideas. And sometimes you just need that outsider's perspective, don't you? It's someone to go,
yeah,
what about this? And you go, oh,
yes.
Oh yeah, good idea.
My agent's quite like that. So there was, so one of the other climaxes where it's really addressing that true story, we just spent ages kind of like, how do we do this without kind of ruining everyone? And how do we do this without the story taking a really awful turn? So she would just kind of like call me up and make suggestions. And she's really like that. You know, she really puts her thought into the, like, she really invests in the book, basically, and becomes part of the journey, which is great. I'm really lucky.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I wondered whether you can remember, obviously, entering the Curtis Brown First Novel Award, which we'll talk about in a bit, but I wonder whether you could remember a moment where you thought, okay, I'm going to take my writing seriously. I'm going to invest in it. I'm going to really try to become a published author. Can you remember that moment, that kind of change? Because I know you've been writing for years kind of for fun and just for yourself. Was there a moment where you thought, okay, I'm gonna start writing with the aim of being published?
Well, I know when we were talking earlier, I was saying that I was writing for fun, but I also was writing. I did want to get published. And that's been the aim since I was six. That's high goals. I wanted to be the youngest person ever published. You know, I wasn't by any means. And so there wasn't a time where I didn't want to get published, I think, even when I was like writing the worst stories about death and horrendous things happening to women when I was like 14, 15, 16. Even then I wanted to get published. So, but I didn't take it seriously, as in I didn't believe that I had it in me until until I saw, finally said, right, I'm just going to apply to do the Curtis Brown course. If I want to do this, I need to know how to do it. Because, you know, it's a big financial investment. It's a time investment, but I didn't mind the time investment. But, you know, it was a big deal to do it. It wasn't just a you know, and it impacted on our finances, obviously, because, as I say, you know, it's expensive, but I had to do it. Mm. And then that changed everything, because then I was a writer.
Yeah. And
well, that's what I thought.
Obviously you met friends on the course and you kind of, as I said, kind of took your writing more seriously as such. Did you approach, because I know, oh, again, we'll talk about the award in a minute, but did you query agents at that point, or were you kind of submitting other things, writing other novels? What was your kind of, I guess, early attempts at getting into publishing?
Well, I did have an agent when I was in my 20s. She was really such a she's still an agent now. I won't say who she is because I'm sure she wouldn't want me to. But she took me on when she was just starting, when she was building her list, based on a partial, and I just then did nothing because I didn't realize how hard it was to get an agent, because I'd literally just sent it out and got offered. So that's been my only experience of querying, really. I wasn't I was terrible. I just used to send out like a couple of chapters to someone going, here it is, the masterpiece you've been searching for. then just get a surprise. But no, I didn't really do anything. I didn't have enough faith in myself, I don't think, to really go for it, to really take it seriously, to really follow those rules until I was on the Curtis Brown course.
Mm.
And I think the timing was right then. I mean, it still took me a good couple of years. Well, it took me, when did I finish that? 2014, and the competition was 2019. But, you know, I had my children in that time, and I didn't have the right idea.
Mm. I think it takes time, doesn't it? I mean, I think, obviously, if you're lucky enough to have an idea when you're really young and have done a course, or maybe you haven't done a course, and then you just go for it and really learn how the industry works, and I'm sure there are people that can do it instantly, but I think sometimes it is a gradual kind of climb, and also learning to believe in yourself and to think it's actually possible. I mean, until I did the Faber course, I didn't even think it was that really possible to be published. I just thought it was just a thing that happened to people that were lucky. I didn't really think it was something
to
achieve.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think understanding the industry is really important, because it's really tough, and it's built on other people's dreams. You know, the product that they sell is other people's. I don't think there's any other industry really like it. Well, maybe music. No, there's probably loads. But I think publishing is essentially, you know, you have all of these people desperate to give you stuff. Thousands and millions of thousands, like people who just will continue to churn stuff out until, and you know, you have a captive market in a way, or a captive area of resources. Publishing industry is built on people who have dreamed of this all of their lives, and when they go into it and it's just a business, that's hard. That's really hard. You're no longer, you know, you've gone from selling your book and everyone telling you that it's great to suddenly be thrown into the, like, this ocean where everyone else has had that experience too. You're through the gate and you're in that's massive ocean full of other people who've said it to you. You're not special. You don't realize that on the other side of the gate, it's just more of the same, you know? And I don't mean that in a kind of derogatory way. I mean that in a way that you're not prepared for that. You're not prepared for the fact that you just become someone who's written a book who, I'm just trying to phrase this properly. You've just moved through that gate into this world where, as long as you keep writing and your publisher likes it, you will continue to have your book published. But if your book doesn't perform, your publisher has got no qualms in going, see you later. Do you know what I mean? There's a real kind of, you don't understand until you're through that gate just how cutthroat it is.
Yeah.
And how it's not about dreams and cups of tea and working on your manuscript. It's about graft. And it's about your product and what you turn out. That's all you are. Sorry, I'm completely cynical. You can cut all that if you want. But I think
I've had it all the time. In that, there's such a difference between the creative side of it, where it's you alone with your ideas and your characters and that kind of. I mean, it's not as flowery as I made it just sound then. Like you say, it's not. Nice laptops and, you know, looking out the window and thinking of your ideas. It is the graft of it. But when your book becomes a book, it's not a book anymore, it's a product. And it suddenly becomes about numbers and marketing, and actually authors are not involved in that part. Like, you've done the work, but you don't have so much say in terms of what the book becomes or how it's going to be sold, and that is so difficult to deal with, because you almost feel like, yes, but it's mine, and where's the control? And then you will learn that there is no control. You're not part of that anymore. The gate has been shut.
Yeah. And I think that when you kind of, I think there's real pros and then there's real cons to joining a group of debuts from your year. So obviously I'm in the 2023 one, simply because there are some people, we all come through that gate really excited and like, yay, here we go. And then some people start to pull away or they start to take the leap because they're talking about the marketing plans, they're talking about these amazing things that are happening. Then you've got other people who are realizing that actually they're not getting the same kind of spend. And then you get people that are realizing, I'm getting no spend and no support. And then and all of a sudden there's this huge disparity. And not only are you facing that insecurity every day when you stare at your manuscript, you're suddenly facing that insecurity every day when you see the other people who are in the same race as you running away. And I think, you know, Twitter, I mean, I love Twitter, as in I love book Twitter. I hate the rest of it. And I like the group is amazing, but I think, you know, it just kind of intensifies and amplifies the whole business side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, it is just a product.
Yeah. Do you listen to the Publishing Radio podcast?
Sometimes I just can't. I mean, the thing is, I am one of those people though that I've had a really good experience. Mm. I think there is nothing I could say about my publishers in the UK and my whole experience of being published in the UK that is bad at all. They have been absolutely brilliant and I have loved every minute of working with them, and none of it has been a disappointment. Well, obviously, you know, the fact it's not a bestseller, like, but they are, it's been an absolute joy. So I am really lucky, and I sound really churlish when I'm talking about, you know, that it's tough. But it's because I've seen it, you know, I've seen it now. I'm on the other side of the curtain. I've seen.
I think I think we all become cynical to an extent because, like you say, we've seen all sides of it. And it's upsetting when you see people who've worked really hard on their book and then the book doesn't do very well, or the book doesn't have the support that it deserves. And then, you know, you see other books that are just flying off the shelves and you think, well, there are books that I've read that are not getting that support that deserve to be flying off the shelves. And it's really odd as an experience. I mean, I wonder how, obviously, both of us have become cynical, twisted people. But I wonder how you've kind of coped through this weirdness, and have you just kind of tried to stay focused on the writing and the kind of the good aspects? Like, what have you done to kind of strengthen yourself?
I think I have this really good ability to completely disassociate with what's going on. And I think this, I've always used my writing for that. I think I always, I didn't have a difficult childhood, but it was quite chaotic. And I think that's why I used to write all the time, just to escape into another world. And so I'm just really good at it. So I don't, it just, I think I was saying to you earlier on, I'm not really good at the writing. I mean, I'm really good at escaping. But it's like I was saying to you earlier on, like, it just feels very surreal, like it's happening to somebody else. So I'm completely capable of disengaging quite quickly. And I think because I've seen some friends go through it themselves, had success, but also heard through them, you know, some difficulties that other people have faced and all that kind of stuff. And one of my friends definitely doesn't sugarcoat things. I'm really aware of all the stuff that could happen. And I think, I don't know, I'm along for the ride. Mm-hmm. You know, this has been the thing that I've always wanted. So I'll just stay on its back, to use the Bronco thing. I'll just kind of ride it. I'll ride it until it kicks me off, I suppose. I don't know. It's really difficult. I guess I still haven't come to terms with the fact that it's even happened.
Mm. Probably better just to be separate from it and kind of not think about it.
It does take the joy out of it a little bit, but you know, keeps me safe.
So it's quite useful to have or to know people, and I know, obviously, you know Fran, who've already been through it and have done it and have
had
it inside and written another book, or have not, or whatever the case may be. It's I always think it's useful to have a friend that's like a year ahead of you or 2 years ahead of you, so you can say, you get to know all the ups and downs before they happen to you. It's kind of quite handy.
I think maybe that's really helped as well, the fact that I'm like ready for it, because Fran has this incredibly bleak sense of humor. She probably doesn't even realize she has it, but she does. And she's always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And I love it when she talks, because she always talks about, oh, it's just a bit of flannel. And I love that. And in fact, I use it in my books because it's such a great saying. And I think, her ability to see through things has been really, you know, she's had a great experience. She really has. But that's been really positive for me. But because she's so direct, it's been very helpful. There's no flannel with Fran.
Should be a slogan on her t-shirt or something.
Should be, yeah. But also the thing is that it means that when things are going right and I ask her and I tell her, for me, I mean, is this okay? What do you think of this? She's just like, that's brilliant. And I know that she's right because it's flannel-less flan.
So I have to touch on the Curtis Brown First Novel Prize, because you were the runner-up, and that also led to you signing with your agent. So I was wondering, tell us a little bit about that. Obviously, Fran encouraged you to apply, and you did. And then, so you became runner-up, and then you got a phone call saying, "I'd like to represent you." How did it all happen?
Oh, that was amazing. That whole experience was just bonkers. So as I say, Fran saw we both saw it, the competition, and Fran said, you're doing this. And so I did it. And I submitted, I think you could submit up to 10,000 words or the first three chapters. So I submitted the first three chapters. And submitted it obviously at the very last minute, on the very last day that you possibly could. And then it was like, it's supposed to be a month before they released the shortlist. And then that went on and I was getting sweatier and sweatier and sweatier. And then I got an email saying, we're announcing the long list, Maura. And then I wanted to vomit because I didn't think they were going to do a long list. And then the following week they did the shortlist, and then I knew the shortlist was coming, and there was no email. And then I got it at 5:15 saying you're shortlisted. And then the following week I got a phone call when I used to work at Stonehenge, and I was in a meeting about the redesign for the Stonehenge website, and I had a London call on my mobile. So I was like, oh, my mobile. Oh my God, I'm so old. Oh, my phone. So I just grabbed it. I went outside and it was Lucy. And she said, the first thing she said was, you haven't won, but you've come second and I want to represent you. And then it was just like, okay, can we speak in a bit? Because I'm in a meeting. And then I went back in and just couldn't concentrate on anything. It was amazing.
Oh, that's brilliant. And a nice way for you to hear the news. I mean, you haven't won, but consolation is represented.
I know. I mean, and I think over 3,000 people entered, and I still can't quite believe that happened. I'd never entered a competition before, you know. It was, and it literally was just, I wrote it for, anyway, blah, blah, blah. I'm very lucky, very, very lucky. And Lucy's amazing. She's just, she's great.
Okay, so finally, Lucy, can you tease us with what you're working on next?
Well, it is historical still. It is about strong women in unusual circumstances. It takes place slightly later in 1908, and it is based on a true story, but not really. It's kind of based on a true thing. It has truth to it. Oh, there we go. It's about ordinary women doing ordinary things, but potentially in an extraordinary way.
Brilliant. That sounds fantastic. And as your natural wit comes through, I'm sure it will have the brilliant tone of your first book.
Well, I hope so. As I say, like, if I'm not having fun when I'm writing, I just don't want to write. Yeah, so
definitely. Well, Lucy, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was Lucy Barker talking about her historical novel, The Other Side of Mrs. Wood, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.